from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Judge Douglas Ginsburg has spent his career analyzing, teaching, and ruling on constitutional law. Now he's hosting the PBS series A More or Less Perfect Union, exploring the Constitution's creation and how tensions over its core protections have shaped U.S. history. A noted constitutional originalist known for a short-lived nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court under President Reagan, he serves as a judge on the United States Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., and Judge Ginsburg joins Forum to preview the series and give his take on constitutional questions facing the current impeachment process. Welcome, Judge Ginsburg.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Delighted to have you here. And let's talk first about the series. Got a big book with this. You've got all kinds of PBS TV going. It's a three-part series with the volume, as many of these series have. And you've got contributions from some pretty big names, major names, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sandra Day O'Connor, Alan Dershowitz, Arthur Sulzberger, but also some names that may surprise people, Jack Nicklaus, Gene Simmons, Dweezil Zappa. Tell us about the picture here of what we're seeing in this pastiche of
well,
people.
The book brings together people from all walks of life. It's called Voices of Our Republic, and that's really what it's meant to be, not just the voices of a few Supreme Court justices, but people who have thought about constitutional issues as citizens. You know, the state of civics education in the United States is really woeful now and has been for a while. But there is a comeback, and this program and what PBS is doing with it are part of the, I think, the effort to restore civics education.
Well, in fact, we've got a cut from the series. It starts with Jonathan Turley, a name that may be familiar to many of you if you were watching the impeachment hearings as they got underway. And let's hear.
One time I was testifying in Congress, and a member of Congress said, you know, Professor, we all know how much you love the Constitution, but, you know, the framers didn't have to deal with politics like this, this vicious political environment we live in. And I almost laughed.
And not surprisingly, one of the first big fights over the Bill of Rights is a fight over the meaning of free expression.
The framers wrote the Constitution. The first Congress added the Bill of Rights. And soon after that, the Congress passed the notorious Alien and Sedition Acts.
It prevents people from criticizing the president. It prevents people from criticizing the president's cabinet.
The Congress passes it, the president signs it, and the courts uphold it. A trifecta of tyranny.
It was outlawing dissent 7 years after the First Amendment was adopted.
Yeah, we're setting a tone there, aren't we?
This has set a tone that has been with us to the present day. The Alien Sedition Acts were renewed in 1918 because of anti-war drafts and protests. I think 15,000 people were imprisoned under those laws. And then in 2001, the Patriot Act has its own excesses, such as national security letters, of which thousands have been issued. These are letters issued by the FBI with no warrant from a court, not FISA court, not any court. They tell the addressee, give us all your information about citizen X. It could be your doctor, your bank, your telephone company. And by the way, you're not allowed to reveal this to citizen X that we've asked for this information. So it can't be challenged.
It just shows how dynamic the document is and how changing and we hope adaptable it is. And yet you have pretty much been characterized as an originalist, and I want to get to that because I've often been challenged myself by the idea of originalist thinking and how it affects our view of the Constitution and how we interpret the Constitution. Because when the framers made the Constitution, there were no women seen as citizens. The abolition of slavery was not a part of the Constitution, three-fifths of a man and all of that. And we took 37 amendments to get to where we are now. So it's constantly changing. How can you get into the minds of the framers? That seems to be suggested when you talk about originalists. I think about the great line of H.P. Hartley, the British novelist, who said, "The past is a different country. They do things differently there." They speak a different language, too.
Well, the Constitution's 230-odd years old. Shakespeare's plays are 400 years old. No one would want to produce one or direct one without knowing what the words meant when they were used. And that's similarly true with the Constitution. The principles embodied in the Constitution, embedded in the Constitution, don't change, except when sometimes our Supreme Court or the Congress has tried or has succeeded in essentially changing them, and the effects have been disastrous. The technology changes, circumstances change, but the underlying principles were right there in the document.
It's like a secular Bible in many ways. I mean, if you're a literalist, isn't it?
Someone on the show says it's the greatest secular document ever written, and I think that's true. It's been emulated by many a country around the world in terms of the writing, but they've never lived up to it, and we've had our difficulties doing so too.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with federal appellate judge Douglas Ginsburg. He's host of the new PBS series, A More or Less Perfect Union, which premieres January 24th, and we do want to get you involved in this program. I want to actually also get you involved, Justice Ginsburg, in talking about the Constitution as it may apply to what's unfolding before us now vis-a-vis impeachment. Before I do that, just a historical memory and footnote, because there are many of us who remember when you were nominated to the Supreme Court, to the United States Supreme Court, after Bork was borked. I mean, that's become part of our language now, and came up that you would smoked or experimented with marijuana, like I did, like many of us did in that era. And so you took yourself out of the running. It must seem very ironic to you now. I mean, with marijuana as a recreational drug in so many states and not much concern about what candidates for the Supreme Court or anywhere else might have done in the way of cannabis use.
That was 45 years ago. And frankly, unless someone asked me about it, as you just did, I don't even think about it. That's not something part of my life.
I think about the fact that you were exposed by Anita Totenberg, I think, in terms of this history. But please.
Can I go back to your reference to the amendments? I just wanted to clarify one thing. The 27 amendments that we have, that's the way to change the Constitution, not by letting the Supreme Court change it.
Well, let's talk about it then as it applies presently to what we're seeing unfold before us. Because
sure.
The House indicts like a grand jury. That's all in the Constitution. And the Senate is the courtroom. So it seems pretty obvious to many, and I wonder what you see along these lines, that with that split of accusation versus judging, the Senate doing the judging, that they should be able to hear evidence.
In the Clinton impeachment, I recall, the Senate took depositions from three witnesses outside the chamber and then shared the transcripts or recordings with all of the members. So they clearly have the power to do that.
And there's an impeachment oath to do impartiality as those who are conducting the trial under Chief Justice Roberts. Can there be impartiality when members of both parties have actually spoken out about beforehand what their beliefs are?
You know, we ask jurors to set aside their beliefs and even things they've read or said and to be impartial, and we have a lot of confidence in the way that that works, that they can achieve that. And I think that's true for senators as well.
So could senators also be possibly free in this year from partisan political motives and pressures, do you think?
Well, they have to set that aside when they're in the Senate chamber for this impeachment trial. Apart from that, I think recent events show that this has been a period of a great deal of partisan divide, of extreme political urgency or divide, and that's been our history. You just played something about the Alien Sedition Act in 1796. That was the beginning, and we've never gotten that far away from it.
Well, the Senate jurors set up the rules. I'm wondering how that squares in your mind with originalist thinking, since it's not what colonial juries did, right?
But the provision in the Constitution is two that are relevant here. Of course, the Senate shall have the sole power to try the impeachment, and the Senate makes – each house makes its own rules. Those are the things we know for sure. After that, it's a matter of filling in and looking at precedent.
Well, we're talking – again, you just joined us with federal appellate judge Douglas Ginsburg, host of the new PBS series, A More or Less Perfect Union, premieres January 24th. Let me invite you, our listeners, to be part of this program. If you have questions or comments for Judge Ginsburg, we welcome you aboard here. You can give us a call right now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. Or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Noel wants to know, what about the debate, whether it's too late to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, of course, Virginia may become the 38th state to pass a ratification resolution, which would give the requisite number. There is a provision, as I recall, in the law now that limits the amount of time that an amendment can be on the table waiting for ratification. That will have to be adjudicated. May well be in my court for that matter. But that was put in because of the lessons of the 27th Amendment. The 27th Amendment was one of the 12 that were proposed by Madison, 10 of which became the Bill of Rights, one of which – two did not, and one of those two was gradually ratified by more and more states in the 19th century. Then it lay dormant for 100 years, and a movement came again to ratify, and it was finally done after, I think, 207 years.
Judge Ginsburg said it will happen perhaps in my court. He's a judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and I should mention he's also professor of law at George Mason University, as well as the host of this series that will begin on January 24th on PBS. Kurt wants to know, when you come on as a judge and leading a show that deals with the Constitution, you probably get all kinds of questions related to the Constitution. Kurt wants to know, one of the biggest constitutional tensions, as he sees it, is about the power of the federal government versus states' rights. We have the Supremacy Clause, yet states make laws regarding marijuana and immigration, et cetera, that are clearly in violation of federal law, yet there's no forceful application of the Supremacy Clause.
Well, forceful application would require a lawsuit. And that, for instance, in the case you've mentioned of state laws on marijuana that are inconsistent with federal law, if the federal government were to seek to enforce that law, supremacy would prevail. And someone who is not disobeying state law would still be in violation of federal law.
Let me bring on some callers. And we begin, Jen, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I recently heard a TED Talk made by a Native American gentleman who made a very powerful argument that both the Declaration as well as the Constitution really lay a foundation for a systemically white supremacist society in the way that it references who has full rights, indigenous people, women, African Americans, and that the amendments have not fully addressed that foundation, and I will take my answer off the air.
All right, we thank you for the question, Judge Ginsburg.
Well, the second episode in this three-part series is called A Constitution for All, because the original Constitution did not provide for, obviously, for voting rights, for instance, for African Americans. That took the 15th Amendment after the Civil War. But between the Bill of Rights and the Civil War amendments, at least on paper, the Constitution became all-inclusive. And then with statutes dealing with sex discrimination and so on, even more so. That's not to say that all of those aspirations were achieved and some of them never achieved perhaps, but it took a great deal of time, largely because of setbacks from the Supreme Court. In 1897, in the Plessy case, the court says, the Constitution says equal but separate and equal are okay. Separate but equal is okay. That set us back 65 years in terms of racial harmony in this country. It was a disaster. And the Supreme Court has done that to us more than once, I'm sorry to say.
And let me get back just for a moment with you, Judge, to the impeachment question, because I was reading Lawrence Tribe and Joshua Matz, both law professors, Harvard and Georgetown, were saying that we get back to the framers and what they had in mind, that they rejected that impeachment be in the hands of the Supreme Court because it would essentially mean the justice is appointed by a sitting president. And they thought the Senate size also versus the court size would be a problem. So they were talking about a safeguard against corruption. I mean, that's a fact, isn't it?
Well, it was certainly contemplated initially at the convention that the matter would be tried in the Supreme Court. Supreme Court's not very well situated for trials, as you can imagine. But the resolution was to put it in the Senate. True. I mean
– And here we are.
Here we are. Right. That was meant to solve a political problem. Of course, it doesn't – it creates others. Let's put it that way. There are no ways – there is no way out of a political environment, even under the rule of law. We're fortunate to have that.
Now, some say the impeachment is a political process. In fact, we keep hearing that bandied about. In terms of the Constitution, how does that square with you?
Well, I think that has to be understood to mean that it may not be necessary to point to a provision in the U.S. Code and say that law was violated by the president. Since the House can impeach without that constraint, and there's nothing in the Constitution that constrains it, it may be possible for the Senate to convict for something. This has not been resolved, but for something that is not in the criminal code of the United States.
And we go to more of your calls. We bring in Casey next. Casey, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Two critical issues facing our constitutional landscape today. First, election and the validity of elections, which is a whole separate program. But the one I'd like to get your opinion on today, Citizens United and the representation of corporate money in our process today.
Floyd Abrams is one of the leading constitutional First Amendment advocates and has been so for about 50 years. And about 2 years ago, he wrote a short article just producing the numbers of the dollar amounts of contributions from corporations and unions, which is what was at issue in the Citizens United case. Turns out the amounts were utterly trivial. They're trivial because corporations don't like, to, at least publicly traded corporations and public corporations that deal with the public and their sales, don't want to alienate half their customers. So they simply stand aside for the most part. There are obviously some major exceptions that are privately held corporations, but in the scheme of things, the dollar amounts are still trivial.
Here's Mike, who writes, the judge says the principles remain, never mind modernity. I'm thinking principles have gone out the window. We need gun control. How could the court vote with straight political ideology on that and try to dress it up as constitutional principle?
I think the court did a creditable job in terms of interpreting the words as they were understood when the Constitution was drafted. You know, the right to keep and bear arms is not dependent upon the constitutional provision. It's not as if it didn't exist prior to the Bill of Rights adding it. So for the 2 years between the drafting of the Constitution and the addition of the Bill of Rights, you think people had no right to possess arms? Of course they did. They had a pre-existing right that some attribute to natural law, some to English common law. The problem that we're facing today is what to make of the types of weapons that can be held.
They're not muskets.
No, they're not. The original meaning, of course, had to do with hunting and self-protection. Those were the functions of weapons, personal weapons at the time. There were cannons then, but people didn't keep cannons in their homes or their backyards.
There weren't any assault rifles, as I recall, though, were there?
No, there were not. And so what you've seen since the Heller decision, to which the caller is referring, I think, since that decision, there have been a couple of score of lower court decisions, federal courts, determining whether one or another city, county, or state limitation on guns is constitutional. The great majority of them have been upheld. So recently, some statute prohibiting taking guns into the state capitol or the fairgrounds. Here in California, there was one dealing with the county fairgrounds. That was upheld. I had a case coming in D.C. after Heller where one of the issues was how large a magazine would constitute a weapon protected by or firearms protected by the Second Amendment. The record was inadequate to determine it in that case, but it looked like, based on the Supreme Court's Heller decision, which asked what's in common use, it looked like 14 cartridges was about the maximum that was in common use.
You know, I'm struck by your love and passion for the Constitution. I share it, by the way. I was reading about your background. You were kind of more interested in law because of business than you were, you know, the traditional kind of trajectory that would have gotten you into law. Do I have that right?
I went to law school thinking I would be a business lawyer, yes.
Not a constitutional lawyer.
No. And after 1 year of law school, decided that I wanted to teach rather than practice law. And over the course of the years teaching, I've taught a variety of things. But what I regard as an extreme problem, you know, everything – it's like the United States has no problems. Everything is a crisis. This is not a crisis, but it is a problem. And that is that constitutional issues are constantly in the news, in the press, as you're describing today with impeachment, with weapons and so on. But people don't read the Constitution. And they weren't educated for the most part as to what it what it might contain, what they maybe ought to look for in the Constitution. So this show that we're talking about, after it airs, and it starts here on QED on the 28th of the month, after it airs, will be available in small segments. They'll be sent out to teachers who've signed up to receive them. There are 170,000 history and civics teachers who are going to receive this.
I think that's terrific.
And they're going to get it in small units so they can use one a week for a semester.
It's great. If you could only get our president to read the Constitution, we're going to go to more calls here. Let's go to you, Leah. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, and that just made me laugh. I'm so pleased to hear about this show that you're going to be doing. I turned personally, after we got our new president, to the Federalist Papers, and this is after Kelly Conway said that nobody understands the word emoluments, you know. So I'm reading away. First page, bottom of the first page of Alexander Hamilton, he discusses not allowing emoluments. Now, it's not in the Constitution, or is it, with the Federalist Papers? Could you answer me that?
I believe the word is in the Constitution. It was the subject of a case brought by the state of Maryland concerning the president's interest in the hotel, the Trump Hotel in
yes.
D.C. And that case, I'm not sure, I frankly don't remember on what ground, but in any event was resolved against the state of Maryland's complaint.
Let me thank Leah for the call. Here's a listener who says, federal judges are not elected, have lifetime appointments and immunity, are answerable to no one, and often abuse their power. To file judicial misconduct charges is a farce, as even judges protect each other. Are the powers judges have given themselves unconstitutional?
There have been 11 judges removed from office, about one every 25 years, for misconduct. Actually, I think the 11 were all by impeachment, and there were more who several who resigned rather than be impeached. So I would quarrel with the notion that misconduct goes overlooked. There is a strong professional norm, very strong in the bar, but stronger still in the courts, about the conduct of lawyers and respectively of judges. Inevitably, there are going to be miscreants. There are fewer than 1,000 federal judges in the United States now, and of course the numbers were lower in the past, whereas there are tens of thousands of state judges who operate under different codes and so on. Some of them are elected. In fact, in the majority of states, at least some judges are elected. The federal judges are not elected. They're appointed for life, as the caller said, and they're subject to a code of ethics. We file financial disclosure reports every year. They're extremely painstakingly detailed. It takes quite a while to fill one out, I can tell you.
It takes quite a while to remove them, too, even if there's transgressive history of some kind along the lines you've just outlined, doesn't it? It's a long process.
Well, it's impeachment. It's by impeachment.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And in instances where there have been impeachments of federal judges, it's nothing like the impeachment of a president. It does not take anything like the kind of time of the Senate or the House.
Let me get another caller on, and that's you, James. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the idea that keeps going around that impeachment is an inherently political action. In my opinion, the way that it's designed, it's a necessary feature, and it's kind of supposed to be team executive. You know, they're not necessarily against each other all the time, but they do need to stand apart from each other. What we have right now and what is inherently political is the two-party system, which breaks that. It means the executive and the legislative side with each other on their political party, as opposed to doing their job of the branches unified to check and balance each other.
So, James, you're saying you're asking Judge Ginsburg about impeachment as a political process, because how can it be pretty much avoided in that vein?
Like the way it's designed, it is not an inherently political process. What makes it an inherently political process is our two-party system, which is breaking the way that it was designed in the Constitution.
So partisan politics. Judge Ginsburg, I mean, the caller's raising an interesting point here. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, James makes a very good point, because the framers did not anticipate political parties. Indeed, their term factions, which was their term for any interest group, were the bane, the thing that they were trying to control, just as James said, through separating the powers and making the branches jealous of each other so that each would check the other. James comes and says, well, right, but now what happens when they're both controlled by the same political party, when the two political branches are the executive and the legislature? And that has been a departure from the original contemplation. There's nothing that can be done about it, and he wasn't suggesting that it should be. But it's not the only way in which the separation of powers and the separation of powers has been compromised. The Supreme Court has – Congress has created and the Supreme Court has approved what Madison called the very definition of tyranny, the combination of all three powers, passing laws, implementing the laws, and judging whether the law has been violated, has tolerated putting all those three functions in certain administrative executive agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Federal Trade Commission. They write the regulations, which have the force of law. The Congress has delegated this authority to them, and they the agencies have put out 18 regulations with the force of law in recent years for every one passed by the Congress. The Congress has irresponsibly, in my view, delegated its authority to make laws to someone else, to the executive branch. And so they get credit for some aspirational law. Who wants to vote for clean air? Oh, okay, everybody. Well, when it comes to the actual burden of clean air and who's going to bear the costs, well, the EPA puts out the regulations, not the Congress. And they don't have the vote on them, even though it may cost the public hundreds of millions of dollars or inconvenience a large segment of the public. So the separation of powers has been compromised in a very significant way.
So it's your hope, as we come to the conclusion of this hour, that people will see this series and they will learn more about the Constitution and perhaps value the Constitution as citizens to a greater degree?
Absolutely. Value the Constitution that we were given and see what we can do about restoring the provisions that have been lost.
Judge Ginsburg, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with the series and congratulations on it.
Thank you, Mike.
A More or Less Perfect Union, a personal exploration by Judge Douglas Ginsburg. It premieres January 24th on PBS. And we premiere with you every weekday, Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. You can. In fact, we encourage you to continue this discussion online simply by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And when we return, we're going to talk with Steve Inskeep, who will be joining us. He was supposed to be with us in studio, but we got preempted yesterday. NPR Steve Inskeep has a book about a 19th century power couple, and we'll also talk with him about present events in the news and how, in the morning edition program, they actually curate the news. All that's up ahead. We'll also talk about the 49ers as we get toward the end of the hour up ahead. So much to listen to and much to be involved in. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.